loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, major technology companies came under heavy pressure on Wall Street today after Apple announced an unprecedented cut in its sales forecast, citing failing iPhone sales and pressure from the trade war with China. It was the first time in more than 15 years that Apple cut its earnings forecast. Shares of Samsung, Microsoft, Intel, and companies that make components for Apple also fell. And this might just be the tip of the iceberg as other companies brace for declining revenues. Next, the New York Times yesterday published an article saying that sexual harassment and sexual discrimination were serious problems in Bernie Sanders' 2016 presidential campaign. The article noted that nearly a dozen former campaign staff members said that Sanders' failure to address the problem in 2016 could jeopardize a run for president in 2020. But is this New York Times attack on Sanders part of a larger effort to torpedo a 2020 bid before it gets started? Then it's time again for our regular weekly segment, Veterans for Peace, where we'll discuss contemporary issues of war and peace that affect veterans, their families, and the country as a whole. What's ahead for the peace movement in 2019? And then, in an historic first, a Chinese lunar rover successfully landed on the far side of the moon yesterday. Chinese scientists said the landing was a bullseye. The rover will conduct a number of experiments and will study the interaction between solar winds and the moon's surface. But the biggest impact of the landing may really be political. And finally, the government of the Democratic Republic of the Congo is anything but democratic. President Joseph Kabila, who has ruled with an iron fist, is stepping down after 17 years following mass protests demanding democracy and an end to the persecution of opposition activists. After repeatedly postponing elections, votes from opposition strongholds are just trickling in, and Kabila has shut down the country's internet, and observers are complaining of widespread electoral irregularities. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the stock market. Major technology companies came under heavy pressure on Wall Street today after Apple announced an unprecedented cut in its sales forecast, citing falling iPhone sales and pressure from the trade war with China. It was the first time in more than 15 years that Apple cut its earnings forecast. Shares of Samsung, Microsoft, Intel, and companies that make components for Apple also fell. And this might just be the tip of the iceberg as other companies brace for declining revenues. We're joined from California by Dr. Jack Rasmus, a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. You can check out his work at www.jackrasmus.com. Welcome back, Jack.
My pleasure to be here.
This is a pretty big deal for Apple. I mean, it's shed something like $300 billion in value just since the end of the summer. What can turn things around for the company? Is it in the hands of Apple, or is this in the hands of Donald Trump and his trade negotiators?
Well, I don't think it has that much to do with the trade situation because the tariffs haven't really hit very hard yet. And as I've been predicting since last May, there will be a trade deal with China. It's just the question of the terms and conditions. And they're mostly agreed on all the issues except the technology transfer issue. I've been predicting there'll be a trade deal here by March. If not, then certainly by May. I don't believe it has that much to do with the trade situation. I think it's a broader picture, deeper picture of the global economy beginning to slow down, as I've been predicting as well. You can see it in the two main goods sectors, housing, construction, commercial property, and manufacturing now. Globally, manufacturing is in retreat everywhere, in China, in the U.S., in Europe. And that's usually a pretty good indicator that the cycle is coming to an end. Add on top of that all the signals, all the indicators for housing contracting, not just in the U.S., but globally, Australia, even China, everywhere. We're clearly, and the real economy is clearly heading into a slowdown. Whether it will be a contraction or not, we'll know over the next 3 months. Apple also made some tactical errors. They overpriced their iPhone. There's not their new iPhone releases, and there's not that much new to it. And you got all this competition growing, particularly in China, from the Android phones. and Chinese companies. And that has a lot to do, I think, with, you know, the obvious indicator that revenues from, you know, Apple will not keep growing at their previous rate. So it's a part business, missteps. It's part competition. It's part the slowing global economy. These are more fundamental reasons that I think are at play here. And it's not just the trade war, which I think gets too much attention.
I just want to ask you, don't want to be the devil's advocate, because who wants to play that role? And I don't have, I'm not spending the time and or have the expertise that you have, Jack. But I just wonder, given the fact that the United States is targeting especially Huawei, the Chinese technology company, and that's while the arrest of their chief financial officer in Vancouver, where she's not in custody anymore. She's under house arrest in Canada. But, you know, that would probably lead to a change in public opinion about brands that might have been prized by, you know, people who had a disposable income in China, like American brands, like Apple. There are indicators that I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal right now. Apple iPhone loses ground to China's homegrown rivals. And the subtitle is, despite developing more features to woo Chinese consumers, Apple's market share has stagnated. So not just about the decrease of people buying phones, but Apple's share of the Chinese market. And they attribute it to a number of things. One, some of the peculiarities about how Chinese consumers are using their phone and how the Apple iPhone isn't as compatible for some of those applications, such as inside WeChat. But what about Chinese nationalism and public sentiment starting to turn against American brands? Do you think it's a factor?
I don't think that's a major factor yet. That could be if there were a true trade war. But I don't think it is. Android phones have a major share in China, and Chinese companies, competitors for smartphones, are using Android. And, you know, there's probably some nationalism there, but the Android phones have a bigger base in China. And I think that's more the case. And also, you can't disregard the fact that consumer spending is beginning to slow in China as well, as consumers see the slowing global economy and begin to, pull back over there. Of course, here, consumers spend more on debt. And, most of our median family consumption is driven by debt, which keeps rising in the U.S. now, approaching $14 trillion, more so than even in China. But the slowing in China and consumers beginning to indicate a pullback in China probably has something to do with Apple's slowing sales in China, which is its biggest market. You know, a lot of factors involved here for the Apple situation. It's kind of like a perfect storm coming together and, analysts beginning to say the price can't hold all the big banks, analysts, and of course then now it collapses and drags down the tech sector. But this is very typical in business cycle turndowns. You know, it either starts in housing and construction, which we've seen weakening, then it moves over to manufacturing, and then to the tech sector, and then to services. It's looking very much like the 2000-2001 recession in a number of ways, with a little bit of overlay of financial instability. As Asia slows down, we're seeing a lot of money trying to flow out of Asia. You could see it in the huge run-up in the yen currency in Asia, the Japanese yen, which is kind of like a holding currency. The money's flowing out of Asian economies. They're trying to cash in as the yuan devalues and purchase yen, which drives up the price again. So we have financial currency instability overlaid on this fundamental manufacturing tech-driven slowdown. So it's kind of like the late 1997-98, the Asian currency crises. And then we had the tech crises in manufacturing in 2001, which makes it unlike 2008, where we had a housing crash.
But Jack, does this necessarily say anything about the intrinsic value of these companies? Is it that the companies are overvalued, or there just happen to be these economic changes that are bigger than the companies themselves?
A little bit of both, but certainly they're overvalued. Why are they overvalued? Because of the massive tax cuts for businesses and investors under Trump, which came on top of the virtually free money by the Federal Reserve under Obama. These are subsidization of capital incomes going on since 2008, first monetarily and then now fiscally. This is a characteristic of 21st century capitalism, states subsidizing capital incomes unlike ever before, both with monetary policy and with fiscal policy. And of course, a lot of that free money and bottom line windfall tax cuts goes into the stock market. And tech has always been a favorite, and Apple at the top of that favorite source, and stock buybacks over $1 trillion a year. And watch for Apple to engage in more buybacks. $1 trillion a year, $1.3 trillion in stock buybacks and dividend payouts this year, following 6 years of $1 trillion plus of buybacks. So that drives the stock prices way up artificially. And of course, it can't be sustained. And now we see that artificial price increase in the value of Apple and tech stocks beginning to come down.
Jack Rasmus is our guest. Jack, we have 1 minute left. The Institute for Supply Management on Thursday, that's today, said its manufacturing index fell to 54.1 in December, partly driven by waning demand. What this means is that American factory activity decelerated last month as demand for U.S.-made products softened here and internationally. If what you're saying is true, and if what these articles seem to be saying, which backs you up, are we looking at a recession this year?
I've been predicting for the year, the past year, that we will likely see a recession by the end of this year, by the fourth quarter of this year. I think there will be a recession. Others, business market analysts are saying 2020. I think it's going to come a little earlier. And I think it's going to be a recession driven by non-financial corporations. And we could have some financial instability as a result of all this free money for 8 years now that's been propping up zombie companies, and they won't be able to make the payments on their debt, and that could lead to defaults.
That was the voice of Dr. Jack Rasmus, who joined us from California. He's a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. Check out his work at www.jackrasmus.com. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. The New York Times yesterday published an article saying that sexual harassment and sexual discrimination were serious problems in Bernie Sanders' 2016 presidential campaign. The article noted that nearly a dozen former campaign staff members said that Sanders' failure to address the problem in 2016 could jeopardize a run for president in 2020. But is this New York Times attack on Sanders part of a larger effort to torpedo a 2020 bid before it gets started? We're joined from Detroit by Julie Hurwitz. She's a civil rights attorney and partner at the law firm Goodman, Hurwitz & James. And we're joined here in the studio by Nicole Russell. She's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Julie, we're happy to have you. How should we look at these articles in the New York Times? And it's been the New York Times more consistently than any other major outlet that, for one reason or another, has taken on Bernie Sanders. Now, these articles make it very clear that Bernie Sanders had no idea that this was happening. These complaints, while they appear to be completely legitimate, they went up to a certain level and they didn't go above that level. But Bernie Sanders has apologized. His wife has apologized, and they've promised to enact changes in the event that he runs for president in 2020. But talk to us about the New York Times and these allegations.
I am very disappointed that this article was run the way that it was.
I feel that it was, these are complaints that probably are not inconsistent with similar complaints that could have come from anybody else's campaign, because as we've learned, and as many of us know from life experience, these types of harassing experiences happen all the time on a daily basis in every arena. So the fact that the Times seized on this campaign to make this story as big as it is at this time is very troubling to me. At the same time, of course, the ongoing problem of sexual harassment in the progressive community is equally as troubling to me. And how we resolve those contradictions amongst ourselves is one thing, but I think that this story is going to do tremendous damage to him going forward, because he's already starting out. If he does decide to run again, which I personally hope that he does, at least at this point, I don't see anyone better than him, I think this is setting him back.
Yeah, Julie, I couldn't agree more. This feels like a really strong, really vicious attack by the Times. You know, I think, unfortunately, it is true that we know, you and I both know, you know, as women who have worked literally anywhere, that this exists in every workplace I've been to. I've worked on campaigns and it has existed. That is not a good thing. We are, as women, working very loudly in a very big and vocal campaign right now to eradicate that, which is why, you know, this was able, I think, to come to the surface. And I'm glad that that conversation is being had. It sounds like the senator is dealing with it in the way that I would hope someone would deal with it. He's apologizing. He and his wife are apologizing. They're figuring out things to do to fix it. But in the meantime, what this really feels like is an attack to really stem the tide of the progressive movement. It's an attack on the most progressive candidate that we're seeing right now for the 2020 elections. You know, we just saw Elizabeth Warren, the first person to throw her hat into the ring. That just happened days ago. This doesn't feel like a coincidence that, you know, somebody who's so strong and who has so many people behind him, who is able to really excite, you know, really big swaths of the American public, that that person has been targeted in this way.
Well, I agree. I mean, and I think obviously his age is a huge handicap to him right now. And that seems to be what a lot of people are focusing on, even on the left. But still, I don't see, you know, I love Elizabeth Warren. I think she's wonderful. I think she's played a wonderful role in the Senate. But, you know, just watching her video announcing her candidacy, I was left kind of flatlined. Frankly, I just don't think she makes the connections that need to be made that Bernie makes very articulately.
This is an ongoing theme, too, because I think there are a lot of progressives who feel exactly the same way that you do. There are a lot of candidates out there that we want to like, we want to support, and we just can't get ourselves there. And then there's Bernie. And we like what Bernie stands for. We like what Bernie has to say. So do we walk away from Bernie because of these allegations, when I agree with the man that he likely didn't know any of this was taking place? And I think that it would be unfair to attack him because of something that that some of his employees or subordinates or supporters were doing.
Well, I mean, there's two responses to that. One is, I'm sure there are going to be a lot of people out there who are going to say, I don't believe that he didn't know this. He had to have known it.
Sure.
Especially if it went as high as his campaign manager. He had to have known it. And maybe they ran it by him and he just sort of shrugged it off and said, deal with it.
Right.
You know, I don't want to deal with this. Who knows? I think this is going to do irreparable harm to him. I mean, I don't think the left is very tolerant anymore of these kinds of indiscretions going on within our own community, and they're not going to forgive him easily for it.
How do you see that playing out then? Do you see it as an Al Franken scenario where he's just going to have to make an announcement and go away? Or do you see him surviving something like this? And if he survives, to what extent?
I'm hoping that he tries to survive and continues to make this a priority. You know, clearly his weaknesses throughout his campaign were his inability to connect with communities of color in our country and now this. So he's going to have to just shift his message a little bit to make sure that these issues and the issues of racism and the interplay between racism, sexism, and what he views as the inherent contradictions of capitalism become more clearly stated. And I think he's just going to have to be, his campaign, if he builds one, is going to have to be much more transparent about how they're going to be dealing with issues like this, because I'm telling you, no disrespect, but you men don't get it.
Well, when I read the New York Times article and I saw that one of Sanders, he was an unnamed representative in Nevada, asked if he could run his hand through the hair of one of the campaign workers, I thought, well, my God, it was 2016. What are you thinking, first of all? And then secondly, well, when numerous well-known news figures call a staff meeting and then attend it butt naked and think there isn't going to be some sort of fallout. Yeah.
What was that, over at NBC?
People don't. It was at ABC.
Yeah. Oh, at ABC. That's right.
And at PBS.
I wanted to bring the debate slightly back to the candidates for just a second. Thank you, John, though. That's a great visual. No, I just think, you know, right now we're looking at, you know, Warren's the only person who's declared, and her thoughts on these corporations who have done so much damage to this economy are thoroughly uninspiring, right? I mean, she wrote an opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal of all papers, and it was defending that Accountable Capitalism Act that she was proposing this summer. And her thoughts essentially were, well, corporations used to be good. And this was, she cites some timelines that were about the time when she was switching parties from Republican to Democrat. But she says corporations were effectively fine, but then shareholders became greedy. No, that's actually how corporations work, right? Like, that shareholders will always be greedy. Corporations will never look out for the good of the people. That's not, you know, and I think that's something that Bernie does so well, is makes it so clear what is actually working for the people and what's actually not. And so I really hope that he continues to kind of bring those really clear points and really coherent analysis to the conversation.
I mean, my greatest concern is that we end up moving in the direction of recreating the type of welfare state that predated Ronald Reagan, which was roundly criticized and disassembled under the Reagan regime and has been ever since. It's like you try to build a system within an institution that is set up to be hostile just by definition to the rights of working people and poor people and people of color, like capitalism, and try to, you know, create a welfare state within a fundamentally capitalist system. Unless you do it really extremely, it is going to fail, because you can't sustain, as we learned, you can't sustain a welfare state when the primary goal is privatization of things and the profit motive and divide and conquer and class struggle.
I couldn't agree more with you, Julie. I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, we have this system that's set up for the elites, for the rich, for the wealthy, for the capitalists, for the people who, I mean, a lot of them are right here in D.C., in Washington, D.C., downtown. We're here on K Street. We see these people every day, but it's not set up for the rest of us. It's not set up for you and me who are just trying to get by, just trying to make what we need.
Well, we will leave it there. We were joined from Detroit by Julie Hurwitz. She is a civil rights attorney and partner at the law firm Goodwin, Hurwitz & James. And we were joined here in the studio by Nicole Russell. She is a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. It's time again for our regular weekly segment, Veterans for Peace, where we'll discuss contemporary issues of war and peace that affect veterans, their families, and the country as a whole. We're joined from California by Jerry Condon. He's a Vietnam-era veteran and war resister who has been a peace and solidarity activist for almost 50 years, currently as the national president of Veterans for Peace. We're also joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. He is a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Welcome to both of you.
Happy to be here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Jerry, it's a new year. It's 2019, and everybody's optimistic, at least for this week. So tell us how you're starting off the year at Veterans for Peace.
Yeah, well, you know, 2018 was kind of a rough year. It, it,
with all these wars going on, multiple forever wars, not being confronted by any really large anti-war mobilizations. U.S. wars and occupations continued in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, Niger, and other places. Seemed like they would go on forever. In Yemen, we were hearing that tens of thousands of children were dying of starvation and disease caused by an intentional man-made famine that our government was actively involved in with a naval blockade. So I think we were feeling a little bit helpless about ending the U.S.-Saudi war. And, you know, thankfully, some groups just kept on sounding the alarm no matter what. And they included groups like Medea Benjamin and Code Pink, who staged many demonstrations outside of Saudi Arabia's embassy in Washington, and Kathy Kelly and Voices of Creative Nonviolence. In fact, they're in on their sixth day of a fast right now outside the Saudi consulate in New York. We're happy to that Kathy Kelly and Medea Benjamin are advisory board members of Veterans for Peace, and Veterans for Peace members are also participating in those actions, as well as vigils in several other cities around the country. So, you know, we're feeling a little bit more optimistic now. We got some traction on the war in Yemen with the Senate actually voting to cut off U.S. involvement. And I think that we're expecting a similar vote in the House of Representatives soon. And then, you know, with Trump's announcement of withdrawing troops from Syria and cutting down, you know, which is really an admission that the Syrians have won that war. They've defeated this incredible regime change war that was supported by the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and way too many others, and including, you know, one of the maybe largest war propaganda campaigns in history. And so things are turning around a little bit. Also, you know, Trump has also announced that he's going to cut the troops in Afghanistan by half. So, you know, he's getting a whole lot of resistance from the military-industrial complex and the powers that be, who kind of want to hold on to those wars. They don't know how to get out of them without admitting defeat. But at any rate, we're feeling more hopeful. We feel like in 2019 might be the year where we can actually put an end to at least some, if not all, of these so-called forever wars. And I think that peace movement overall is going to be feeling more optimistic, and we'll have some growth and some new opportunities. We're going to have to really seize the moment and step up our game, but I think that's going to happen.
Jerry, one of the things that's been shocking to me in the last week or so is the number of American veterans who have been expelled from the United States because they were undocumented when they joined the U.S. military. Now, these are guys and women, presumably, who fought valiantly in some of these wars that we have. They were decorated. They came back to the United States and they were unceremoniously arrested and deported. So talk about that and what Veterans for Peace has been doing to help those people.
Yeah, well, we have there's been hundreds of veterans have been deported going back a number of years. This didn't just start under Trump. So these are our veterans who came to the U.S. as young children and were legal residents here, grew up in the States. It's the only place they know. But for some reason, they hadn't become citizens. Many of them joined the military in part, thinking that would help them finally finalize their citizenship status. And that's what the recruiters promised them. But there was no follow-through by the military, so they were just repeatedly deployed to this war and that war. They came out of the military, like many other veterans, kind of injured physically and psychologically, spiritually, got into, you know, self-medicating with drugs and alcohol, got in a little bit of trouble with the law, ended up going to jail. And then when they got out, instead of rejoining their communities, they were just taken to the border and pushed across. Of course, they're not all, I'm talking about the border with Mexico, but of course there's people who've also been deported all over the world, like, you know, back to Pakistan, for example, where they're likely to be targeted because for assassination, because they were in the U.S. military. So back to Pakistan, Iran, and many other places. But there's quite a few in Mexico, and there's a strong, they've formed a really strong community there in Tijuana, Mexico. I'm right across the border from them right now in San Diego. And We've been working very closely. They've actually, they're now a U.S. Unified Deported Veterans chapter of Veterans for Peace. And so they've been, they have a strong community of supporting one another. Some of them have been there for over 20 years, and some of them have just arrived in recent months. And they are quite an exemplary bunch of guys, and most of them are men. There are some women also, but most of them are men. And they've actually, aside from taking responsibility for their own situation and fighting to build public pressure and awareness and get support in Congress for them to be able to eventually return to the United States, they've taken a lead now in supporting the caravan of Central America asylum seekers. They're providing material aid and moral support and a way for Veterans for Peace members around the country to be involved in that effort. We've been across the border many times recently. San Diego Veterans for Peace is taking material aid down. We are actually going to have our upcoming Veterans for Peace board meeting in Tijuana. They're really providing an amazing amount of leadership for people who are in such dire straits themselves, and we're really proud of them.
I'm looking at the at your end of the year message to VFP, is we can end the forever wars in 2019. And, you know, you talk about the big military interventions that the United States has going on around the world in Syria and Afghanistan. But, you know, you also mentioned the regime change push that's underway in other parts of the world. For instance, you referred to John Bolton's Troika of Tyranny speech, right? You know, the effort to instigate regime change in Cuba and Venezuela and Nicaragua. Talk a little bit more about that, if you would. I mean, there's, you know, the overt shows of force that the United States uses to control people around the world, but there's bullying too.
Right. Well, the U.S., you know, it's been been meddling in and occupying and meddling in and overthrowing governments and installing right-wing dictatorships in Latin America forever. I mean, going back, you know, more than 100 years, and that has taken various forms. Now it's often in forms of sanctions and covert activities. And that really ties in with why are all these asylum seekers suddenly coming? That's a big exodus, as they're calling it, from Central America. Well, because there's so much violence, not just poverty, but violence from the government in Honduras and Guatemala and in Salvador, and also street gangs that actually started in the U.S. and got deported back to Central America. So the U.S. is responsible for a lot of the conditions that are causing this huge exodus. And, you know, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama supported the coup in Honduras several years ago. And then another phony, violent election more recently to keep a right-wing violent government in power in Honduras. And now, more recently, there have been efforts, kind of more of a covert effort to stir up and fund and support an attempt at a coup in Nicaragua. There were street protests around a number of issues, but they were obviously being stirred up by the U.S. and by USAID and funded and fomented in an attempt to get rid of one of the few progressive governments in Latin America right now, the Sandinista government in Nicaragua. So that effort has apparently been defeated, but it goes on. And sadly, you know, it's complex enough, and the propaganda is so powerful that even peace and solidarity activists in the U.S., including former solidarity activists with Nicaragua, have been confused, you know, because the Ortega government in Nicaragua is certainly not perfect. It's got some issues, but it's a real mistake for people to extend that criticism to the point where they're supporting a U.S.-backed attempt to overthrow one of the few progressive governments in Latin America.
That was the voice of Jerry Condon. Jerry joined us from California. He is a Vietnam-era veteran and war resister who has been a peace and solidarity activist for almost 50 years, and he's currently the national president of Veterans for Peace. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short message.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
In an historic first, a Chinese lunar rover successfully landed on the far side of the moon yesterday. Chinese scientists say the landing was a bullseye. The rover will conduct a number of experiments and will study the interaction between solar winds and the moon's surface. But the biggest impact of the landing may really be political. We're joined from London by Jude Woodward. She's the author of the book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. Welcome back, Jude.
Hi there. Happy New Year.
Jude, Happy New Year. I read every article I could find about this lunar landing, which is fascinating to me. The technology involved, the important experiments that are taking place. But I was surprised that it was not one of the top stories in the Chinese press, of all places. Why do you think that is?
Well, I noted the same thing myself, actually. It appeared not on the main news pages, but in the science and technical pages. So I've really got no idea why that's the case, because it seems to me to be worthy of a much higher profile than that, because it's such a significant step. It's the first time that China, in its space program, has done something that nobody else has done before.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, interestingly enough, people call this the dark side of the moon. It's actually not dark. It's just as light as the side that we see. It's just that the rotation of the moon keeps one side toward us at all times. But anyway,
that's because of Pink Floyd, right?
Yeah, exactly. The dark side of the moon. but the far side of the moon does not receive radio signals because it doesn't have direct line of sight with the Earth. The Chinese went to the trouble of launching a dedicated satellite just to be able to transmit from the rover to the satellite back to China in order to conduct these experiments. So there was a major commitment of money and of scientists and in technology. This is really something, well, in my humble view, this is something that ought to be celebrated in the worldwide scientific community.
I agree. I mean, I think this satellite is called Chui Chow, and it's obviously a huge investment to put this out in space, because this orbits beyond the moon. China is collaborating with a number of other countries on this probe, not on the actual probe and the landing and the technology and actually getting there, but some of the experiments which are now going to be done, in particular looking for signals from outer space, because it's considered that this may prove a very good place to look for signals from outer space, because the far side of the moon is protected from radio signals from Earth. These are being done with Germany, I think, Sweden, other countries are involved in this. And yet, as you say, there's very little fuss about it.
You know, the NASA administrator, the U.S. NASA administrator, Jim Bridenstine, he congratulated China. He sent it by tweet. Congratulations to China's Chang'e 4 team for what appears to be a successful landing on the far side of the moon. This is a first for humanity and an impressive accomplishment. So here you have the management and the scientific part of NASA congratulating the Chinese. I think that the Chinese government and the Chinese state-owned media may have downplayed this story, because while it is an impressive first step for humanity, they don't want it to be like a Sputnik moment. And just for our listeners who are listening to Radio Sputnik, they might not know that what happened in 1957 when the Soviet Union launched Sputnik, the first satellite into space, what happened is the United States went crazy. It launched a new arms race. It was like the Russians, the Soviets were considered to be like a poor, backward, ignorant peasant country, and suddenly they were ahead of the United States in exploration of outer space. And as a consequence, America created an anti-Soviet hysteria, not only to race to get a man on the moon, but more importantly, to make the argument that the technology that could launch Sputnik could also send nuclear bombs towards the United States. And I think China, Jude, this is my theory anyway, and it's just a theory because I'm not in the room over in China. I think the Chinese, under the current political circumstances, are very scared that if they start to brag about this achievement or even make it a big deal, the U.S. will say, see, it's like China 2025. The Chinese are trying to, you know, replace the United States as the dominant power, and so China's going low-key.
Well, I think that's probably accurate.
It's just a theory.
Well, that was what was in my mind, too. I know that China has been very careful. I mean, but this is in line with all Xi's speeches, etc. But the chief scientist, when he was talking about the success of the Chang'e 4 landing, said, was very careful in his language to say that this is a demonstration of human intelligence, i.e. not a demonstration of Chinese prowess or technology, but of human intelligence. Of course, the US doesn't have to feel so nervous as Sputnik made it feel, because it's just also done a first, which is to get the probe out to Ultima Thule, which is a very significant thing in space exploration. So this hardly puts China ahead of the US in a total space exploration sense in the way that Sputnik did put the USSR temporarily ahead.
I wonder if there's going to be, Jude, a different view coming from the United States 10 years from now, 11 years from now, when the Chinese finally land a man on the moon. Do you think that's going to make any kind of a difference?
I think it's already made a difference. Just to jump in here before Jude responds to you. You know, when I was looking at U.S. media reports, they had an alarmist feel about them, as if even though the United States spends five times as much as China every year on military, the United States is clearly in the lead. Nonetheless, there was an alarmist sort of note being signaled by the Western, by the U.S. media about this development. I think China's right if they're worried that the U.S. could just pretextually use it to launch more of an anti-China campaign.
Yeah, well, I think that's right. I think particularly in the context of the new talks on the trade war and trying to calm the situation in order to get things back on track economically, the last thing China wants is the appearance that it's launching a new round of a technological war, and this time in space with the US. As I say, I think that's not accurate because, anyway, I mean, well, that's not what China is interested in doing, but it doesn't put the US on the back foot in the way Sputnik did. What it is an indicator of the fact that China is continuing to advance technologically, and this is for the China hawks, not what they want at all. So I think there's a whole series of sensitivities around this, particularly in the context of the trade problems and, you know, Apple having announced a fall in its profits in China, and there's tensions around the whole situation. I think the last thing China wants is to appear to be winding things up.
Yeah. Again, I'm looking at the NASA website about the launch of Sputnik. The Sputnik launch also led directly to the creation of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA. That was in July 58. Sputnik went up in 57. Sputnik was the size of a beach ball.
Yeah.
It was an artificial satellite the size of a beach ball. It weighed 183 pounds. It took about 98 minutes to orbit the Earth on its elliptical path. And then NASA said, that launch ushered in a new political, military, technological, and scientific developments. While the Sputnik launch was a single event, it marked the start of the space age and the US-USSR space race. Again, I was a young kid, so I wasn't obviously paying attention to the news, but I remember distinctly during the years right after that, that the whole US media was inflamed by the idea that we are behind, that the Soviets with thermonuclear capabilities, the capability to wipe out Americans, and we were all getting under our desks and practicing about how to survive if our elementary school was actually hit by a nuclear bomb. We got under our desk, we put our hands over the back of our head. Anyway, it was a genuine hysteria. It's not, as Jude has said, it's not like that now. But I think the Chinese are so tuned in to the sort of prickly, ultra-sensitive nature of the American political establishment, where anything that China does that's good, anything that advances China that's good, which of course development would be good, is considered sort of a loss by the United States, a danger to the United States. And Jude, in our last minute, that's why the Chinese keep emphasizing they're not competing directly with America. They're trying to promote this win-win strategy. Our development is not at your expense. Last minute, go ahead.
Yeah, well, exactly. It's not just rhetoric on China's part. I think this, we've had many, many examples of it. This is what Xi and the Chinese government seriously believe. They don't believe humanity can, as a future, on the basis of winner takes all foreign policy and technological development. They want to try to promote a set of international relations which are based on mutual benefit, collaboration, development, and compromise. And they're trying to persuade the US of that so far without much success. But they don't want something like a success they have of landing a moon probe on the far side of the moon to become a pawn in that.
Well, we will leave it there. We were joined from London by Jude Woodward. She's the author of the book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The government of the Democratic Republic of the Congo is anything but democratic. President Joseph Kabila, who has ruled with an iron fist, is stepping down after 17 years following mass protests demanding democracy and an end to the persecution of opposition activists. After repeatedly postponing elections, votes from opposition strongholds are just trickling in, and Kabila has shut down the country's internet, and observers are complaining of widespread electoral irregularities. We're joined from Washington by Kambale Musavuli. He's the national spokesman for the Friends of the Congo, and he's one of that country's leading political and cultural voices. Welcome back to the show, Kambale.
Thank you for having me.
Kambale, even in the United States, where the Congo doesn't get very much press, this election has gotten a lot of press, and that press has been mostly about the problems that we've seen in the election. There's been violence, there have been repeated delays, there's been this new outbreak of Ebola, which may or may not have affected voting, and now today the internet was taken down by the government. Tell us what's happening in Congo, and tell us how it's affecting the counting going on for the election.
Yes, the larger story in the Congo right now is the will of the Congolese people. The reason even why we are having a discussion around the elections is because for the past 2 years, the Congolese people have put their feet in the streets and their will for the world to see to make sure that the Congolese government organize presidential elections, which is now 2 years delayed. But what's the context? The president of the Congo has been in power for two presidential terms, and the second term ended on December 19, 2016. And since that time, the Kabila regime, the Congolese government, has refused to organize timely election. So for us to even talk about the discussion, to have a discussion around elections, we have to applaud and commend the effort of the Congolese people to push the Congolese government to uphold the constitution of the Congo. But now, today, with the Congolese people showing their will to have elections, it did take place on December 30th after 2 years' wait. But we have witnessed since the elections an attempt by the current regime to rig the elections. In many places across the country, there are many irregularities that I could go on for the entire show discussing. But what was actually most egregious was what happened in three towns: the town of Beni, the town of Butembo, and the town of Yumbi. The Congolese government decided in this town where there are 1.2 million voters that they will not participate in the elections. The reason that they gave is because in the Beni region and Butembo region, you have the Ebola crisis, and then there is violence around this area. While the government decided for 1.2 million voters to be disenfranchised, the Congolese people in the town of Beni actually organized a popular election. They decided to create their own polls. They decided to have people to come and vote, write who they voted for, counted these votes, and publish the result of the vote in that area, just to show the world that while the government may say that there is Ebola, there is violence, the people themselves, in the midst of this so-called violence and disease, are still able to organize election. So beside that, on Sunday, the Congolese government decided to shut off the internet. So across the entire Congo today, people do not have access to the internet. But why are they doing that? Because if you look at statistics, Congolese do not have access to the internet. Internet penetration is only 6%. But the purpose of shutting off the internet is to make sure that the information around election results from different polling stations, from observers, and those who have come to monitor the elections, and sometimes some of them are also Congolese who are looking into the results, are not able to transmit information with the outside. So they are more concerned with international credibility of the elections than actually organizing an election in DRC, and which is quite sad. But I do believe whenever the results are published by the government, it's not going to reflect the will of the Congolese people. They will probably declare the winner being the candidate that the current president has chosen, and that will actually cause the population to rise up. And as they rise up, it's quite obvious that the state security forces will assault the people. That's why it's important at this juncture, as we discuss elections, and we know what will be coming in a few days, that the entire world watch what's happening in the Congo, because the interest of the Congo doesn't just end with the Congolese. It ends also outside of the Congo for those who want to have access to Congo's minerals.
Well, let's talk about that, because when you think about the history of the Congo, it's impossible to look at that history, examine that history, understand it, even in a small way, I'm talking about the modern history, without also contextualizing it in the force of colonialism, Belgium in particular, but in fact, all of the European powers were in on the looting and plundering and pillaging and creating spheres of influences and colonies throughout Africa. After the colonial era, after the end of formal colonialism, there was neocolonialism. And of course, the United States, perhaps trying to supplant the Dutch and the Belgian and the British and the French as the major power, and the Portuguese as the major power in Africa, have played such a dominant role. And now we have, of course, under first Obama and then the Trump administration, building this vast network of drone bases throughout Africa. What's the U.S. attitude right now towards Congo, and what is the U.S. strategic orientation towards the country?
Since the modern day founding of the Congo in 1885 at the so-called Berlin Conference, the United States has always had a position of having access to Congo's minerals. I think most people forget that whenever they carved up the African continent, the United States was actually at a table represented by Harry Sanford, and they supported the bidding of King Leopold to get access to Congo as his personal property. The United States was the first country to recognize the Congo as the personal property of King Leopold. And that's something we continue to remind the youth in the Congo to be very clear of the role of the United States government inside of the Congo. Today, just this past week, we found out that Eric Prince, the infamous CEO of for the former Blackwater, has interest in the Congo. And the way we're finding that out is that he is raising, as we speak, $500 million to invest in mineral resources, one of them, cobalt, in the Congo. So Eric Prince, who was a former advisor to Donald Trump, the current administrator, whose sister, DeVos, is the Secretary of Education in the United States, has now financial interest in the DRC. But how has this come about? This past July, the Congolese government organized a meeting with investors and different policymakers where they were literally offering to the international community, I would say to American investors, access to cobalt. Who attended the meeting? Rudy Giuliani. And Rudy Giuliani was quoted by the Congolese ambassador saying that his purpose of being in this meeting is to make sure to help in the sanctions against Congolese officials that the United States has imposed on them.
Well, that's something that Rudy Giuliani specializes in, isn't it? We've heard the same thing with the Mujahideen-e Khalq, the Iranian terrorist group that hired Rudy Giuliani to lobby on their behalf. And it was Rudy Giuliani who got them removed from the State Department's list of terrorist groups. And he's taken millions of dollars from that organization.
And this is happening right now in the Congo. So whenever I'm usually told by certain people in the United States that the U.S. has no interest in the Congo, they are not implicated in the Congo, I point that out that just now, Eric Prince is raising $500 million to get access to Congo's cobalt. He understands the value of the Congo, right? The issue is that people are not informed about the U.S. role in the DRC and what they have done through the companies over the years. From Freeport-McMoRan, which had the largest copper reserve in the world, they invested $1.2 billion. Freeport is in Phoenix, Arizona, and sold the mine to the Chinese. So when you hear people talk about China in Congo, but they bought these mines from the Americans, right? So it's not a question that it was the Congolese who gave them the copper mine. It was an American company that made a lot of money on that. But the interest of the United States continue to be access to strategic minerals, such as cobalt, uranium, coltan. And when we speak about cobalt and coltan, cobalt, you cannot have a Tesla vehicle without Congo's cobalt. It actually has Congo's cobalt there for a fact. Why I'm saying that is the supplier of cobalt to Tesla is Glencore. Glencore is a mining company in the DRC, operating from Switzerland, but has mines in the DRC. So we know for a fact a Tesla car has cobalt coming from the Congo. But what will that mean politically for the elections to come? It will mean that the United States will have to be in contradiction with the will of the Congolese people. The Congolese people want the Kabila regime to end. They want a leadership that will represent them, such as the leadership of Patrice Lumumba back in the 60s, where he said he wanted the resources of the Congo to benefit the Congolese people. That's the type of leadership Congolese are looking for. Yet, the United States government, which had people with ties to the government, go to a meeting in July of 2018 to discuss Congo's cobalt, their interest will be to keep the status quo as long as there is a continuous flow of strategic minerals. So that is the challenge of the Congolese people, whereby they want to represent the government, but they are facing outside forces that will impose leaders on them who provide access to Congo's resources.
You know, John, before we go at it, what Kambali is saying just reminds me of Marine General Smedley Butler's book, War is a Racket. He said he's a retired Marine general. War is a racket. It always has been. It is possibly the oldest, easily the most profitable, surely the most vicious. It is the only one international in scope. It is the only one in which the profits are reckoned in dollars and the losses in lives. In this case, outside powers have been really at war against the people of Congo to take those minerals, to take cobalt now. You have mercenaries and organizers of mercenaries like Eric Prince. They know what it's all about. It's a racket, and it's their racket. It's designed to make them millions, perhaps billions of dollars. The Congolese people are trying to take their country back.
Indeed. We were very pleased to be joined from Washington by Kambale Musavuli. He's the national spokesman for the Friends of the Congo, and he's one of that country's leading political and cultural voices. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.